in this psalm that speaks to our hearts, as we've been reminded of divine omniscience, of the divine omnipresence, and of divine omnipotence, we discover that there are few psalms which present such a change of heart in the writer himself. I refer to a change of heart from what is expressed at the beginning of the psalm to what is expressed at the end. We discover there is an element of awe, a feeling of being overwhelmed in verses 1 to 12, and that by a knowledge of divine omniscience and the divine omnipresence. Answer the psalmist in verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Everything indicates a restlessness, an overwhelming state of unease on the part of the psalmist. However, when we come to verse 14, we observe an important change. So the psalmist, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. The psalmist now finds himself not only at ease in the presence of God, but his heart rises in praise to God. And why? From being overwhelmed because of his thoughts of God, he finds himself enthralled by the wonder of God's thoughts about him. Verse 17, how precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! Thus in verses 1 to 12, the psalmist thinks about himself. In verses 13 to 18, the psalmist thinks about his God. If the psalm commences with that sense of awe, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me, verse 1, we discover it ends with an invitation for the Lord to do this very thing. Verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And why is this? In the last section of the psalm, the psalmist so thinks as God thinks, that he says in verse 21, do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? For the psalmist is so desirous of thinking aright that invites divine scrutiny. We are reminded that the psalm divides itself into four sections. Verses 1 to 6, we have, as we've been reminded, divine omniscience of every human action. In verses 7 to 12, divine omnipresence, be it in terms of distance or darkness. In verses 13 to 18, we have divine omnipotence, fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderfully made. And the psalm closes with a twofold plea. And the twofold plea is this: slay the wicked and search me. Verse 19, oh, that thou wouldest slay the wicked. Verse 23, search me, O God. Now just to run down the psalm again, and much of it will be by way of confirmation of that to which we have already listened. Verses 1 to 6, divine omniscience. O Lord, says the psalmist in verse 1, thou hast searched me and known me. Obviously, this is introductory. It refers to God's searching eye and God's knowing heart. Not necessarily seeing and knowing the secret sins of my life, nor matters about which I might be ashamed, but as the verses follow might indicate, God's interest in me. Verse 2, thou knowest. Thou understandest. Verse 3, thou compassest, thou searchest out, thou art acquainted, therefore thou knowest altogether. Now what is it in verse 2 that Jehovah knows? Thou knowest my down sitting. When I relax and sit down after a busy day with all its problems and heartaches, its joys and successes, a busy day when I've been weary and disappointed, or joyous and encouraged, and mine uprising, when I rise in the morning with bold anticipation or fearful apprehension. My friend, let me remind you, the Lord knows. Further, verse 2, what does the Lord understand? Thou understandest my thought afar off. That is the purpose of my heart for each day that lies before me, even though its fulfillment might be afar off. Christian friend, he understands. The psalmist says so. Verse 3, still further, he compasseth, he searcheth, he sifts my path, my journeys, as I go hither and thither. They're all known to thee in minute detail. As one winnows or sifts, thou hast traced all my journeys. Even when on my journeyings I find that rest is necessary. Verse 3, my lying down. This detail is also known to thee, and is a separate detail from my journeyings. And still more, with all my ways, the varied way in which I conduct myself in different situations, thou art acquainted. And still more wonderful, thou dost know what I am going to say, as our brother has reminded us, even before it is uttered. Known altogether to thee are the machinations of my mind. Before I speak, thou dost in fact anticipate my words. This is how, as we've learned, verse 4 should be understood. Mr. Darby's rendering is, for there's not yet a word on my tongue, but lo, Lord, thou knowest altogether. Answer the psalmist, the fact of the matter is, I'm not a free man. I'm not the free man that I might think I am. Thou art behind me. Thou hast beset me behind. Thou art before me and before. Thou art above me and laid thy hand upon me. And thus there are bounds set by God, says the psalmist, that I cannot pass. Little one, the psalmist has to exclaim in verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. I could never rise to it. It is high, I cannot attain it. Verses 7 to 12, the divine omnipresence. With such knowledge, detailed, intimate knowledge of my varied actions, my purpose, my thoughts, and my words, and the manner in which thou dost circumscribe me, could I not in fact get away from thy spirit, or escape, or flee from thine own presence? If I go up, if I go down, if I go away, thou art there. Thy hand shall lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. Thus it is not therefore escaping necessarily from divine wrath that's in view here, as we've been reminded, but the knowledge that he cannot escape Jehovah's interest in him. Christian friend, isn't this a wonderful thought? We cannot escape the Lord's interest in us. Do I speak to someone away in heart from the Lord tonight? Let me tell you this. You'll never get outside of God's interest in you. Verse 7, as far as thy spirit is concerned,
Whether could I go to be outside of his influence?
As for thy presence, the word is thy face.
Whether could I flee so thy face does not look down upon me?
If I were to go up into heaven,
even in distant heaven,
thou art there.
If I were to go down to Sheol and make my bed or couch there, behold, thou art there.
I want to observe an important omission here.
You notice the two words "are there" are italicized. And Mr. Darby omits them rightly so in his translation.
And so the psalmist, if I were to go down to Sheol and make my bed or couch there, behold, thou.
Not thou art there, but behold thou.
Not by thy spirit, but in my conscience. That's the thought.
Verse 9. If I go and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and the right hand shall hold me.
And I believe, as our brother Flanagan mentioned, that this is to be taken literally.
And the psalmist is thinking of the great sea, the Mediterranean.
Then the psalmist is saying, if I could take or mount the wings of the dawn and fly to the west as fast as light, as fast as the rays of the rising sun, and dwell and settle down in the regions beyond the sea, away out there in the west, thy goodness would still be there. Thy hand to lead, and the strength of thy right hand to uphold.
Thus saith the psalmist, be it height in terms of the heavens, or depth in terms of hell, be it breadth in terms of the uttermost parts of the sea, there is no escape.
No escape from thy presence in heaven.
No escape from thine influence in Sheol. No escape from thy goodness in the regions beyond.
Now in verses 11 to 12, it's not height, nor depth, nor breadth, but darkness and light.
Not ascending, not making my bed, not flying on the wings of the morning,
but simply saying.
Notice the language, verse 11, if I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me.
Verse 12.
Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, and the night shineth as day.
The darkness and the light are both alike to thee.
In effect, the psalmist is saying this.
What in fact is the point of saying?
Surely darkness shall cover me, and the light that is about me become night, and I shall be shut in.
The darkness cannot hide me from thee. With Jehovah, even the night shineth as the day. For darkness and the light are both alike to Jehovah.
In verses 1 to 6, in the daily round of life, the psalmist thinks of omniscience. In verses 7 to 12, in the matter of hypothetical ambition, the psalmist thinks in terms of omnipresence. But if that sitting down, weary and exhausted, of the daily round of life should become the ambition to make his bed or couch in hell, if the rising up in the morning to face the daily duty should become the ambition to ascend up into heaven, if my path or my journeys and my rest periods should become the ambition to fly to the uttermost parts of the sea, there is no escape. Since thou dost anticipate my words, he says, why should I say, let the darkness cover me? Since thou art behind me, and before me, and thy hand upon me, I can never be hidden from Jehovah. Now verses 13 to 18, divine omnipotence. If thou, Lord, in thine omniscience, can take detailed account of all my ways from day to day, and even anticipate my spoken words. Verses 1 to 6. And if in thine omnipresence, both thy presence and influence are everywhere, and I cannot escape. Verses 7 to 12. Why then, such interest in me? What is man that in thine omniscience thou knowest and understandest all about him? Why is thine omnipresence an assurance of thine interest? Thy hand to lead, thy right hand to uphold. The answer is given now in the third section. And what is it? Not only is man the creature of divine omnipotence, but in formative days, when as we've heard, hidden in his mother's womb. Not only is he not hidden from God, but each individual, in all the interesting prenatal days, is the matter of divine information, divine formation. The one from whose eye he cannot be hid, from whose interest he cannot be separated, as he moves hither and thither. His eye was upon him even before he was born, even when in his mother's womb. Therefore God is interested in his own creature. Now verse 13. For thou hast possessed my reins, and thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. Thou hast possessed my reins, and thou hast covered. The idea in covering, as we've been reminded, is thou hast knit me together in my mother's womb. The Lord, so the psalmist, has possessed my reins. The word is my kidneys. And of course the kidneys symbolize man's divinely given capacity to know good and evil. So the psalmist, thou possessest my reins. Indicating the Lord retains and exercises his right both to check and to approve. Thou possessest my reins. Why? Says the psalmist, man is God's creation. Then he goes on to say, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. Thou hast screened me, as our brother Flanagan has said. Or if you will, thou hast knit me together. Isn't that interesting? Thou didst originate the elements of my body. Thou didst knit them together. Its nerves and its blood vessels, its fibers and its sinews. Thou didst knit them. Thou in fact didst interweave them. Verse 14, the result is this. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. I loved our brother's Flanagan's, our brother Flanagan's interpretation of this. It was new light to me. I would agree with it wholeheartedly, that this refers to God who is fearful and God who is wonderful. Verse 15. My substance, my bones or my frame, was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, curiously wrought or embroidered in the lowest parts of the earth. What is the psalmist saying here? Simply this. My bone framework, when I was made in secret, was not hid from thee, even when this bone framework was embroidered in the lowest parts of the earth with vessels and nerves. The psalmist speaks here of the lowest parts of the earth. This, of course, is no doubt figurative of his mother's womb. An allusion, no doubt, to man's humble origin from the dust of the earth. Now, this is repeated figuratively. That is, man's humble origin is repeated figuratively in man's prenatal experience. I wonder if Job has this in mind when he says in Job 1, verse 21, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. to my mother's womb. Well, he doesn't return to the mother's womb, but he returns to the dust of the earth. Thus Job seems to have the same thought in his mind. Now verse 16 is most interesting. We read verse 16 like this. Thine eyes did see my unformed substance. Some suggest that the expression of unformed substance literally means roll together. I might refer to the fetus or the embryo. And in God's book, all of the members of his body were written. Again, figurative, number one, of perfect acquaintance. But also, speaking of God's design book, they were in the book of God's own design. Which in continuance, or better, during many days. Isn't that interesting? During those prescribed days, they were fashioned, when in fact, there was none of them. Verse 17, said the psalmist, I'm occupied now with thy thoughts toward me, and thy purpose concerning me. Answers the psalmist, in their quality, they're precious, and in their quantity, they're great. Not now in verse 17, the thoughts concerning the miracle of prenatal work, prenatal workmanship. Fearful and wonderfully made. The word also in this verse must be observed. It indicates the thinking of something different now. And what he's saying is just this. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, thy purposes concerning my life. How precious also are thy purposes, O God, concerning my life. In other words, I'm no longer filled with awe and restless. I'm no longer thinking of fleeing from thee. Indeed, thy thoughts toward me are not only precious, their sum is so great, I cannot count them. I discover they're more in number than the sand. And I rather think of Brother Flanagan is correct here, that as the psalmist is thinking of them, because of their quality and quantity, he falls asleep. But he says, when I awaken, I am still with thee. And what he means is just this. I would not desire to flee from thee now. I am still with thee. And I would not wish it to be otherwise. Now I am at home. In thy presence, I am still with thee. Now the last section, verses 19 to 24, with the psalmist's twofold play. Verse 19, slay the wicked. Verse 23, search me. Now whether this section be related to an experience in the life of David, or as some suggest, added later, and relate to the condition of things in the reign of Hezekiah, we will not think about that this evening. But evidently here there are two parties in the mind of the psalmist. Notice in verse 19 he speaks of the wicked, that is the lawless one, and the bloody man, the man of blood. Thus there are two parties here, the lawless one and the man of blood. This wicked or lawless one would appear to be some lawless one who would usurp the throne. With all the disastrous results, both upon the king and the nation, both in the daily round of life of the subjects and their liberties, and in fact in the services of the priest and the Levite, in the matter of the nation's God-given worship. And the psalmist's plea was that God would slay such an one, not because of any personal enmity on the part of the writer. Oh no. It's the plea of one king against another king because of God's special interest in the nation. And the verse should read something like this. Oh, that thou wouldest slay the wicked, the lawless one, O God. Then said the psalmist, depart from me therefore, ye men of blood. Now it seems that these men of blood were near to the king. For he says, depart from me therefore, ye men of blood.
Not only were they near to the king and men of blood, but they would not seek guidance from the Lord before plunging the nation into war. Instead of seeking Jehovah's mind in the matter, they might not only blame Jehovah for the situation, but wickedly professed to have Jehovah's mind in the matter. Thus verse 20 reads like this: "For they speak of thee wickedly. They take thy name in vain, thine enemies." And the psalmist goes on in the next verses, verses 21 and 22, to state that this plea of his, was not for any personal reasons. Listen to what he says: "Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies." If in verse 18 the psalmist says, "I am still with thee," he loves his Lord and his presence. In verse 20, when he says, "And I hate them that hate thee." Now, as our brother Flanagan has told us, this might not be a Christian attitude, but the underlying principle is right. In other words, dear brethren, we have to choose where we stand. You may remember that in Gethsemane, they came to arrest Jesus with lanterns, torches, and weapons. And John 18 verse 5 says, "And Judas, also which betrayed him, stood with them." He stood with the enemies of Jesus. Of course, the same chapter, John 18, says that the servants and officers made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. As far as Judas was concerned, he stood by deliberate choice with the enemies of Jesus, whereas Peter stood in weakness and bewilderment. But brethren, we have to make our choice as to where we stand. Now, the closing verses contain, I suggest, a solitary lesson. Having expressed his hatred of the enemies of God and his desire to be separate from wicked men, he looks up to God and he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, prove me, and know my thoughts. Know my anxious thoughts. Know my conflicting thoughts." And thus the psalmist now lays bare his heart to the searching scrutiny of the eye of God. And he says, "Know my heart and try my thoughts, lest there be any wicked way in me." Some render this, "Lest there be in me any way of grief, any way of pain, a way of sin that would lead to grief, grief to himself and to his God, and lead me in the way everlasting, the age abiding way that leads to God." Now you say, what is the salutary lesson? And I close with this. Brethren, we have to remember this, that aversion of evil and separation from wicked men can be purely an external matter. You see, that's the danger. Aversion of evil and separation of wicked men can be purely an external matter. In other words, I might separate myself, yet have a heart just as wicked as those from whom I separate. And there can be the great danger. Who were more separated from evil than the Pharisees? But who were so wicked as them? Whited sepulchres, full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Let us not forget that 2 Corinthians chapter 7 verse 1 follows hard in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 verses 17 and 18. We hear a lot about 2 Corinthians chapter 6 verse 17. "Wherefore come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing." But says Paul in chapter 7 verse 1, having therefore these promises, dearly beloved,
let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And we've seen in our readings this week that 2 Timothy 2 verse 22 follows 2 Timothy 2 verse 19. 2 Timothy 2 verse 19. Let everyone that nameth the name of the Lord depart from iniquity. Then Paul goes on to say, and flee youthful lusts. In other words, the psalmist says, I hate them that hate thee. I've separated myself from evil men. But he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Prove me and know my thoughts, lest my heart be no better than those from whom I've separated myself.